A season of uncertainty for the Maine lobster industry. Lobster is not only one of the icons of Maine, it is also a huge part of the state's economy, supporting thousands of families across the state. Like other farms and fisheries, lobstering is a roller coaster in the best of times. But 2020 has been like none other. The industry has faced China trade tariffs, lawsuits over endangered right whales, warming waters, and now a global pandemic. The lobster industry's biggest customers, restaurants and cruise ships, have either shut down or scaled back. That means demand for lobster is way down. But lobstermen and women are resilient. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the uncertain future of the lobster industry and some of the creative ways lobstermen are getting by. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. These are tough times for Maine's billion-dollar lobster industry. The pandemic, the lawsuits over endangered right whales, tariffs, and climate change are all hitting the industry at the same time in a perfect storm. Today, we'll discuss how bad the situation is and some creative ways the lobster industry is working to survive. Joining me, Marianne LaCroix, who is Executive Director of the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative, and Pat Kelleher, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Marine Resources. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you been affected by this hit to Maine's lobster industry? As a consumer, have you been making an effort to buy more lobster during this pandemic? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Pat and Marianne, thanks so much for joining us. But first, on the line with us for just a few minutes is Senator Angus King, who is joining us to discuss a report that just came out this morning from the Senate Intelligence Committee on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The New York Times is calling the report sprawling. Senator King, have you had a chance to read it? And if so, in your view, what are the key takeaways?
Well, I think the first takeaway that's really important, Jennifer, is to realize that this is a bipartisan report. We've been working on this. This is the fifth volume of this investigation over 3.5 years. And this was reported out by a voice vote. I think there was one negative vote. So I think that's important for people to understand that this was a bipartisan piece of work. And I'm proud of that fact that we were able to maintain that even through this very contentious issue. The second thing is that this report is an important historical document. It's a detailed account of almost 1,000 pages of what happened in the campaign of 2016, particularly with regard to the Russian campaign and the relationship to the Trump campaign. But it's also forward-looking in the sense of what do we learn from this and how do we protect ourselves from foreign interference in our political life in the future. And to me, that's the most important thing. And I hope that people will look at this. We don't reach conclusions. We basically lay the facts out and say, here it is. Here's what happened. The American people are smart enough to draw their own conclusions. But it has some pretty disturbing and serious matters discussed.
Why not draw conclusions?
Well, I think that probably gets to the question of how did we maintain a bipartisan approach? If we drew broad conclusions, yes, there was collusion, or yes, there was cooperation, or yes, there was a conspiracy. Obviously, there are political, heavy-duty political considerations of that. It's really a coincidence that we're so close to the election. I mean, we hope to have this thing wound up, a year or two ago. I have to say that part of the problem was the White House was uncooperative. They were asserting executive privilege over things that occurred even before Donald Trump was president, but that really complicated and slowed things down. But I think the lack of conclusions is that it would just be so overlaid with politics that we just thought the better approach was to lay the facts out and let people make up their own minds.
You mentioned that there are some things in this report that are disturbing. There's already been so much reporting that's happened and you know, hearings. And I'm wondering, is there anything in here that's going to surprise the American people, or is it really a compilation of what we've already learned?
Well, I think it's more detail than we've certainly known before. We had, something like a million pages of documents. We had access to raw intelligence. We had hundreds of interviews. To me, Jennifer, if you want to pick one moment, it was in early August 2016. Paul Manafort, who was then Donald Trump's campaign manager, he wasn't just some guy hanging around the periphery of the campaign. He was the campaign manager, met with a Russian intelligence agent and shared detailed internal polling data with this Russian agent. Now, maybe that, you think, well, it shows Donald Trump up by two or Hillary up by five. No, internal polling is a blueprint for a campaign. It tells the reader where the vulnerabilities are of the other side, what issues are working, what the demographics are, what groups you need to work with, and also importantly, where the effort should be concentrated. It's a roadmap. And to me, having the campaign manager giving that information in the summer of 2016 to a Russian agent is a pretty serious matter.
Senator King, we're having this conversation, as you mentioned, right on the cusp of another election. Maine's absentee ballots started going out yesterday. Matt Dunlap says already 6,000 have been requested, by the way. And I'm wondering if you feel confident that the mistakes made in 2016 will not happen again.
Well, I don't. I mean, I feel confident that we're better prepared than we were before. But unfortunately, for 4 years, the president has been calling this a hoax. And that means that a lot of people believe him. And it isn't a hoax. It happened. The Russians definitely were deeply engaged in the 2016 election. And in the end, they were there to try to help Donald Trump. So and they're at it again. We know that. We had a report from the intelligence community, appointed by Donald Trump, by the way, about 2 weeks ago, pointing out that the Russians are back at it. Chinese and Iranians are also working around the periphery, but the Russians are the serious actors. And the best way we can defend ourselves, Jennifer, and that's why I think a report like this is important, is to know it's happening so that we can shrug it off. We can say, oh, that's just the Russians again. For example, this whole business about Ukraine being the source of the problem in 2016, that's Russian disinformation. That's a Russian part of the Russian playbook. And to the extent people are told that that's, what really happened, that's not true. And I think people need to understand that this project of meddling in our democracy isn't over, and we're going to have to be on guard.
Senator King, we'd love to talk to you about this topic further in the future, but I want to switch gears quickly to today's main calling topic, which is the state's lobster industry. I understand you've been involved in efforts to make sure it survives this really wretched season, and I'm wondering what your focus is. What can you do as a U.S. senator to help the industry?
Well, there are lots of ways. One is we've been fighting back against the tariffs that were the result of the administration imposed these unilateral tariffs on China, as you know, more than 2 years ago. One of the first things the Chinese retaliated against was lobsters. And we had a really growing market. It was, I think, Marianne LaCroix can tell you, but I think it was our fastest growing export market was China. And that's gone to practically zero. I mean, it's been devastating. Pat Kelleher can talk to you about some of the regulatory things and the right whale issue and how to navigate that to protect the right whale, but also not unnecessarily cripple the lobster industry. So you characterized it perfectly, Jennifer, at the beginning where you said it was a perfect storm. The combination of the tariffs and then COVID, lobsters are eaten in restaurants, and the restaurant industry has been hit probably harder than any other business. So you put all those things together. What we're trying to do is get some money from the administration. I wrote a letter back to the president, and the first line of the letter was, why not lobsters? If you're sending money to soybean farmers who've been hit by the tariffs, why not lobsters? We had exactly the same kind of impact. So we're fighting on all kinds of fronts. We had a big call last week on the right whale issue. Pat Keller can tell you about that. And it's a really tough combination when you add together the tariffs, the pandemic, and some of the other issues facing the industry. And by the way, I don't like using the term industry because it's really 4,000 or 5,000 individual entrepreneurs. There are some processors, but the heart of this so-called industry are families along the main coast. And I think we need to think about this as the ultimate small business that is so important to the state of Maine.
Well, Senator King, thank you so much for calling in. Senator King serves on the Rules, Intelligence, Armed Services, and Energy and Natural Resources Committees. We're going to have much more on the Intelligence Committee report later on All Things Considered. Turning now to the topic at hand, Pat Kelleher, give us a broad perspective, not only on how important the lobster fishery is to Maine, but what kind of numbers are we facing this season?
Thanks, Jennifer, and I appreciate you asking me to be on. I think it seems to me the only thing that the lobster industry isn't facing right now is Russian interference. We're dealing with, as you said, a perfect storm. First, I want to give tremendous credit to the individuals that make up this the industry. The senator's right; it's all small businesses. They've had to pivot like they've never had to pivot in the history. They're used to challenges. They're used to change. But in this case, COVID has really struck in a way that has disrupted the markets like never before. But in this particular case, the dealers have been able to pivot. They've found additional markets. Back in April, I was having calls with the industry, and we thought we were facing $2 a pound boe price. The price is still down. The price is—it's still a very good value for a high-protein product. But what they've been able to do is find some additional markets in a very short amount of time, and in doing so, they've helped stabilize the boat prices. We're seeing boat prices range from $3 to $4 a pound. Coupled with the cost of doing business in this industry, with the high price of bait and the high price of fuel, is still just covering costs. But we're in a better spot than we thought. We're still down, and it could change in a moment's notice, depending on how this pandemic might change. But at the end of the day, we're holding our own, I think, as an industry.
I want to bring you into the conversation, Mary Ann. The Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative is normally busy getting the word out about the desirability of Maine lobsters, branding Maine lobsters. Tell us how this whole, explain to us how this whole, Senator King said he didn't like the word industry, but the whole supply chain is affected. Of course, restaurants are ordering lobsters, but it's even more than that. Explain how it all works.
Sure, Jennifer, and thanks for having me on. Normally, about 70% of seafood is eaten in restaurants, so that's obviously a major market for us, and there was a lot of uncertainty this year with restaurants. So back in the spring when the pandemic hit, we were looking at this and as the lobster dealers were and saying, where are the opportunities going to be this year, and recognize that supermarkets are going to be the opportunity where everyone's cooking at home now. And knowing that a lot of people don't cook seafood at home, what we wanted to do is make sure that we had the resources available to make people comfortable doing that. So how to cook lobster, how to prepare lobster, and also recipes that they could do with items that might already be in their pantry, because this year is very different where people are grocery shopping less as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm one of many people. A local lobsterman is selling cooked lobsters every Sunday in our neighborhood. I've eaten more lobster than ever before. It's a wonderful problem to have. And I'm wondering if we're seeing this across the state. Are we seeing more and more people have access to lobster in ways, lobstermen who used to sell mainly wholesale, now selling to their neighbors and selling in their communities?
We've seen a lot of different avenues for selling lobster this year. And as Pat mentioned, the fishermen are very creative, as are the dealers. And everyone's looking for the best opportunities to sell their product this year. And they're coming up with some really creative solutions.
Well, speaking of, calling in now, Kristen Porter, a lobsterman based in Cutler and board president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Thanks for calling in, Kristen.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's pick up on that chain. What are you hearing from the people in the Maine Lobstermen's Association? What are people doing today, this summer, that they haven't done before?
Well, absolutely. This spring and through the first part of the summer, a lot of guys are selling direct to the public. That's still happening some, but as you know, the main lobster industry lands about 100 million pounds, so that's a lot of eating for local people. So we still rely on the on the supply chain. Yet that selling to local helped get us by the first part of this pandemic. But we're kind of in the traditional sales now, but there things have slowed down some. So
yeah, sure. And I mean, all of these challenges you're facing, are you worried that after 2020 the lobster, and we have to use the word lobster industry, there's not another word for it, but that there will be many, many families no longer lobstering?
Well, we hope that we can, the industry will struggle through this year. If actually I expected maybe the price to be a little bit worse than what it is now with the way things were going in April and May, but some restaurants have opened up, so there are lobsters moving. If we can maintain even the price we have right now, most guys, if they use, some business sense, can get through this year and hopefully, live to fish another day next year. But it's just everybody's just holding on and holding a turn for this year.
So everybody's pretty much just trying to cover costs.
Yeah, and I mean, the price is probably, 20 or 25% below what it's been, traditionally this time of year. So that's the money that your extra, the things you might do extra, at the end of the year. So hopefully guys are just, we'll get through and hopefully things will be back, hopefully to normal next season.
Kristen, is it all right if I ask you to stay on the line for the conversation?
Sure.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Pat, I want to turn to you and talk about some of the other aspects of this, not just the supply chain, but then we're right now, today, waiting for some big court decisions that have to do with the endangered right whale. Explain where Maine is right now, where Maine lobstermen are, and what you expect and when.
Yeah, so the right whale issue is kind of the big looming dark cloud over the industry as far as what might be coming next. It's important to point out that the Maine lobster industry has been engaged in protecting right whales now for decades. We've removed the float rope from the fishery. We've replaced over 27,000 miles of floating of that rope with whale-safe sinking line. There's been a very large reduction in vertical lines already, and now we've put a Maine-only mark in place so we can show that the gear that is being recovered from right whales, or any whale for that matter, is not from the state of Maine. We've not had an entanglement since 2004. That all being said, some environmental groups, national environmental groups, have filed lawsuits in federal court. That court case is moving along. The agency was found at fault for not following the Endangered Species Act. So that decision has come down, and now we're waiting, and we could hear any time now if this particular judge and the D.C. court will make additional changes to the fishery. It's our hope that his ruling will say to NOAA that they need to follow the law and set a deadline by which they will have to finalize both what's called a biological opinion and the proposed rule. There is also a second case, Max Strahan, a.k.a. Mad Max, as how he's referred, filed a suit in the Bangor Federal Court after winning a very similar lawsuit in Massachusetts recently. He asked for some controls to be put on the lobster fishery. In fact, his recent motion, which was just denied by Judge Walker in Bangor, said that that the Maine fishery should not be shut down until they could find a way to fish without vertical lines. So it's a small victory for the lobster fishery right now, but the fact is that the judge needs to make some additional decisions in that case as well. So there's a lot being played out on the court side. We do know that the proposed federal rule is undergoing internal review through the Office of Management and Budget in D.C., and then we expect that to be released in the early part of the fall. So that is where we hope to see that the Maine plan is front and center as far as reducing risk to right whales.
Well, we're talking about Maine's lobstering families, Maine's lobster industry. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from payroll management, customized payroll processing, serving businesses as small as one employee and up. PayrollMGT.com. By Rosemont Market, offering local Maine groceries for in-store shopping, curbside pickup, and home delivery. RosemontMarket.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage basement moisture problems with encapsulation and sump pump installation. More at EvergreenYourHome.com.
Liberty University has been a center of white evangelical politics for decades. Jerry Falwell Jr. was its outspoken public face. But after a string of scandals, some students are worried.
It just feels like he's just clowning around. I guess it just doesn't really feel like he acknowledges the full weight of his actions.
Liberty students on Falwell's ouster this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Leadership matters is the theme of the second day of the Democratic National Convention. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders making the case.
I know that Joe Biden will begin that fight on day one.
Live coverage of the DNC tonight with recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 9 o'clock on Maine Public Radio and 8 o'clock on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about Maine's lobster industry and how it's coping during the pandemic. Joining me, Commissioner Pat Kelleher with Maine's Department of Marine Resources, and Marianne LaCroix, Executive Director of the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Our email address, and please send a brief email, is talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Marianne, before we take calls, I want to ask you about something that the senator touched on a few minutes ago, and that is the loss of the sustainability certification. That goes into effect August 31st, is my understanding. And explain to me what that is and what that means for lobster marketing in Maine.
He was referring to the Marine Stewardship Council certification, which is a certifying body that basically, works with fisheries to make them more sustainable, actually. And so it's something a group of companies within Maine applied for and have had for several years now. And that has been suspended largely because of this issue with the court case, the ongoing court case right now with right whales. So we're waiting to see how that plays out from a marketplace standpoint. Some customers, primarily retail customers, do look for that MSC certification, but others don't. I mean, this is an incredibly sustainable fishery that we have right here in Maine, and that hasn't changed. Maine has been following all the regulations, as the commissioner said. The industry, the fishermen have been involved with this for decades. They've been making significant changes to the way they fish over the years in order to make the gear safer for whales. So none of that has changed. The only thing that changed now is that NOAA has been had an interim ruling that they have not been following the Endangered Species Act. So the Maine fishery has been following all the regulations. So
all right. And NOAA is the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, which oversees the fishery on a federal basis. Correct, Pat?
That's correct. Yeah.
And this certification is different than the Seafood Watch that many consumers are familiar with. You're also working with them. Tell us about that, Pat.
Yeah, they've talked about potentially redlisting Maine lobster as far as the issue around sustainability. And I think it's really important to highlight what Marianne just said. Maine lobster are managed in one of the most sustainable fashions as far as any fishery anywhere in the world. Highly, highly sustainable fishery. The issues that both MSC and the Monterey Bay Aquarium are bringing up are issues related to right whales. Same thing, same issue. The fact of the matter is nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed are right whales continue to die in Canada. So it's very disappointing that both of these groups are going to be looking at these listings. After a very good call with Monterey Bay Aquarium last week, we're hoping that we're going to have some additional dialogue so they understand exactly where we are with the federal rulemaking, because these rules are all going to be in place for the next fishing season, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Yeah, that's right. And when you say Monterey Bay Aquarium, that is where the Seafood Watch listing is based. Kristen, before we move on to listener calls, wondering if you wanted to add anything from the lobsterman's perspective of the importance of these listings.
Yeah, I mean, like Marianne and Pat both said, we've done everything that's been asked of us. We're following all the rules. Our fishery is sustainable. And the fact is we've had these certifications for a number of years, and absolutely nothing's changed. We still haven't entangled a whale since 2002. So the only thing that's changed is the lawsuit. So we're hoping that we can get this straightened out, and people can feel confident that eating Maine lobster is a good thing to do.
We'll go to Ben calling from Luke's Lobster. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. Ben Conniff, are you there?
Sorry,
go ahead.
I had some issues with my mute button, but I am here.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just, you know, I was calling in on the topic that we were speaking about earlier in terms of the fishery's ability to pivot in tough times, and specifically looking at the effect that COVID has had on lobstering, and honestly, we're talking about lobster now, but really all of the fisheries in Maine and beyond, as Marianne brought up, 70% of seafood typically being eaten in restaurants is a huge deal. And, you know, for us at Luke's, we actually encompass all of that, because we're buying directly from fishermen, we're a processor, and then we operate restaurants. So we're living that balance where there are restaurants that typically were the home for the vast majority of our lobster are either closed or definitely slowed in their volume. So I think some things that have been really heartening and positive about this have first been the way that fishermen actually stepped in to help us feed the front lines at the start of COVID. We had a situation where, you know, as our restaurant business was slowing, we started raising money and making lobster rolls for healthcare workers. And we actually immediately got outreach from our partners out in Tennant's Harbor Fisherman's Co-op, Cranberry Isles Co-op, Port Clyde Co-op, and Friendship Co-op about how they could contribute and be a part of feeding hospital workers. So they actually contributed lobster donations, and together we made lobster mac and cheese that we delivered to hospitals and other long-term care facilities around the state. So that was one way in which, you know, not to save their own skin, but just to be a part of the solution, lobstermen and their families kind of reached out and pivoted in the moment. But beyond that, I think we also have a potential opportunity here to look at that 70% of seafood being eaten in restaurants and ask why that is. Because as Marianne was getting at before, people just aren't as comfortable as they should be cooking lobster and other seafood in the home. So, you know, it's on us to really educate consumers, convince them that it's actually not any harder to cook lobster at home than it is to cook any other protein that they're used to. And then on our part, you know, we, within a week of kind of the gravity of COVID setting in for us, we started a direct-to-consumer website where we could ship lobster from our fishermen directly to anyone in the 48 states.
Great, Ben.
And that's, yeah.
I invite you to... Yeah, I would love to hear about that, and I invite you to go onto the Maine Calling Facebook post today and put information about that into the comment section, because I appreciate your call. It relates to a tweet we have. Where can Mainers buy cooked and picked lobster that benefits the fishermen directly? Kristen, do you know?
A lot of places have... obviously, it's direct to consumers, like places like Luke's and others, but there are individuals that are doing it. I'm not sure about the cooked, but I know a lot of people are set up in most communities just to buy right directly off their dock or off their truck.
All right. And I found, just doing some research for today's program, a Facebook page called Maine Fish Direct. And I thought that was pretty neat that it's all over the state, apparently, people putting up opportunities to buy Maine fish. So moving to another email here, or the Facebook post, wanted to put into perspective some of the costs of doing business that lobstermen face today. Look at rope, for example. A fisherman hauling 800 traps in pairs at an average depth of 35 fathoms will require a minimum of 84,000 feet of end line. It would take approximately 70 coils of rope to get his or her traps to the ocean floor. At a cost of $150 per coil, the total cost of just end line is $10,500. Rope wears out and has to be replaced every few years. Add to this the license, the boat insurance, maintenance, bait, fuel, sternman, traps, buoys, etc. So, Peter, thank you for that spelling out of what kind of costs lobstermen face. And one thing I'm wondering as I read this, though, Pat, we're talking about ropes and line. How close are we in the year 2020 with all the technology to some sort of technology that dramatically changes the way lobster is fished?
Well, certainly the issue around trying to find ways to fish ropeless has become a very high priority for many different people. That technology is still years away. People think that it can be done very easily. I know Christian can speak to what he saw himself when he was in Australia and how they do it there. But when you look at the fact that the Maine fishery has such a does have such a large footprint, but it is also interacting with other fisheries, mobile gear fisheries, for instance, draggers or gill netters or the herring fleet. People need to know where that gear is so they can promulgate their own fisheries. And then besides that, the Maine Marine Patrol also must be able to haul that gear to ensure compliance. We haul over 20,000, do 20,000 hauls of a year as it pertains to the commercial gear that's on the bottom, so we can check to see if they're using the right vents. Is that gear tagged? Is it properly set up? Is it whale compliant? That is a big, big piece of what Maine Marine Patrol does, is ensuring that the gear is, in fact, whale compliant. There's a lot of technology out there. There's a lot of people talking about it, but it's far from being ready for prime time.
And Kristen, tell us about Australia.
It was 2014. I went to Australia, and there's one person basically that we know in the world that's using this ropeless technology in the lobster fishery there. You get over the pod and you send a signal and buoys pop up, so it's not actually ropeless, but he does it in a vacuum. He has no other fishers around him. So I became friends with this guy, and he's come to Maine and gone on my boat and just basically said that he couldn't do it here the way we fish, because we fish around other people.
Right.
And the cost is cost prohibitive as well. If you take, you know, those figures that you added up on a rope is small compared to what ropeless technology cost is. The equipment on the boat and the equipment that needs to be on the traps is lobster fishery doesn't make enough to at this point to justify that type of investment.
All right. I'm going to go to Larry, who's calling from Machias Savings Bank. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. You've touched on the many challenges facing the industry, but there's a lot at stake here, not just for the fishermen and their families, but there is a lot at stake for the entire state of Maine. Everybody's aware it's easy for all to see the fishermen in the boats. They're very visible. Not so visible are the many other areas of impact: the boat building, bait dealers, truck drivers, retailers, wholesalers, restaurants, gas stations, trap dealers. All the retailers across Maine impacted as these dollars come through their doors as well. The tourists that travel to Maine to eat a hot-boiled lobster. Jennifer, for years we have watched the phenomenon where the economies of our coastal communities ebb and flow based on whether or not the fishermen had a good year. The industry has been a bright light for these communities from Portland to Eastport, and a bright light for Maine, because beyond the local communities, these families spend their hard-earned dollars across Maine. So, I mean, the industry is one of the few stable opportunities that our youth have had to live, work, and raise their families where they grew up, following in the footsteps of their fathers and grandfathers. This way of life is more at risk today, in my opinion, than any other time I can recall. So I have personally donated to the Maine Lobster Association. Machias Savings Bank has contributed significantly. We cannot afford to be passive, and so we ask the people of Maine to stand with us and support the industry.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, Larry. If you'd like to mention something or comment or have a question about Maine's lobster fishery, give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood, a Maine company committed to sustainable fishing practices and partnering with the Marine Stewardship Council, by the Lunder Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, who are bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum, and Breakwater, inviting you to learn more about their outdoor learning spaces and plans for the school year. school.breakwaterlearning.org.
Mary Nasson, a locally famous herbalist and exorcist, died in York on August 18, 1774. Mary's husband Samuel erected a headstone with her likeness, a footstone, and then placed a heavy stone slab between them, covering the ground over her body. In ensuing years, a legend took root that Mary was actually a witch, and her husband had placed the stone slab there to keep her from crawling out of her grave. Historians disagree, saying that Mr. Nasson placed the slab there to keep cattle from damaging the hallowed ground. Her grave is famously known as the Witch's Grave.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is on a twice-a-week schedule, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for Tuesday and Thursdays each week, and carried here on Maine Public Radio as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're discussing the many challenges facing Maine's lobster industry and what is being done to help. My guest, Marianne LaCroix with the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative, and Commissioner Pat Kelleher with the Department of Marine Resources. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Steve Kingston, who is the owner of the Clam Shack in Kennebunk. Thanks for calling in, Steve.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm great. Tell me about the impact of the pandemic on your restaurant. What are you seeing this summer?
Yeah, it's been pretty tough summer. I'm not going to lie to you. We were off to a dismal start. It's gotten a little bit better as the summer has progressed. But it hasn't been easy. We are very well known for our lobster roll, in which we use as much Maine soft-shell lobster as we can possibly get. And that certainly hasn't been a problem to get it this year. But we're trying to keep our guys going.
Mm. What about in terms of your workers? Have you had to cut back on staff?
Yeah, it's been more a matter. We certainly did. We started out with just the bare bones staff that we kind of have year round, a bookkeeper, an assistant, a head of our seafood market. And then as slowly as business has gotten a little bit better, we've brought on some of our normal summer college students and high school students.
I understand you've done some things a little bit differently, and especially when it comes to your lobster rolls.
Yeah, we started doing a lobster roll kit. We kind of pivoted. We've done it in the past on a very limited basis, but my lobsterman was very, very worried about how much we were going to be able to buy from him this year, and we put some real good effort into the packaging and shipped gold.
Oh, shoot. I think we're losing you, Steve. Well, I appreciate having you Oh, there you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling in today. Steve Kingston, the owner of the Clam Shack in Kennebunk. Pat, something that we haven't talked about yet, but I think is really important in this conversation. The Gulf of Maine, as we know, is warming at a more rapid pace than pretty much anywhere else in the world. What do we know about the short-term and long-term impact on lobster in Maine?
Yeah, that is the $64 million question for sure. We know that climate will impact lobsters. We saw firsthand what it did in southern New England. We saw a shift. Basically, is that we had lack of recruitment in southern New England. That lack of recruitment resulted in lower catches over time. There was some belief that those lobsters crawled north. That's not the case. It's a recruitment issue. We're starting to see some slight declines in some of the harvest in the zones closer to New Hampshire. Mass and New Hampshire are also seeing some slight declines. We are seeing some very good numbers mid-coast and down east. We still see a lot of juvenile lobsters on the bottom. But over time, if we continue to see the water temperature warm, it's been a benefit up till now because you actually get an expansion of habitat. Those lobsters, juvenile lobsters, can settle into the right water temperature in deeper water, so it expands their habitat. But after a while, it'll actually erode the habitat, and we could see impacts in the future. It's the timing question. When will that particularly happen? And we don't know. And that's what the Atlantic State Marine Fisheries Commission is working on right now. We initiated an addendum to deal with resiliency of the stock. We had to stop that work in order to deal with the right whale issues. We'll kick that work off again, look at some new reference points and new triggers to ensure that we can manage this fishery sustainably and longer into the future.
And what about the change in the pH, the so-called ocean acidification? We know it's happening, maybe not quite at the same rate as the Pacific Coast fisheries, but how is that affecting lobster here?
So that is a concern as far as the shell fitness as far, with juveniles. There is ongoing work there. It has been an issue. It's certainly been a very big issue on the Pacific with shellfish. We're not seeing it to that extreme here on the East Coast. We're lucky in that sense, but there is ongoing research around pH and larvae, lobster larvae, and the impacts there. So too late to speculate what that means long term, but there is some good work going on there.
All right. We'll go to Martha calling from York. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I just wanted to thank you for discussing all the problems that lobstermen are facing right now. And I also wanted to tell you about my niece has a company called Off the Boat Lobsters on Sewell's Bridge in the York on the York River. And she sells lobsters cooked. So and that's really helped us, I think, this season. So
has she seen can you tell us about how her sales have been? How much of a, I hope, increase in sales?
They've been pretty good. Again, it's called Off the Boat. She's got a great website. She does specials with like steamers and fish. And so, and I think also we're closer to Mass in New Hampshire. York Beach is very popular. So I think that's really, really helped us this year. The price is a little bit lower, but she's got a good thing going for us.
Well, Martha, thank you so much for calling, and good luck to your niece.
Thanks for having the show. This is great. Yeah. Thank you.
Jennifer, I think that's a really important point that's come up several times on the call today, is the fact that people don't know what to do with seafood as far as dealing with it and preparing it themselves. But that last caller referenced a website. The Maine Collaborative, Lobster Marketing Collaborative, has a fantastic website about cooking and preparing lobster. And I think during this pandemic, what I've heard and seen is more and more people are kind of breaking the mold. They're deciding, hey, listen, I'm going to go buy some lobsters. They look on the Facebook, they see those Facebook sites, they know there's somebody, a local lobsterman, selling within their community. They're going, they're buying lobsters, they're cooking, and all of a sudden they're realizing, hey, this isn't as kind of scary as I thought it was going to be, right? It's actually a very easy process. And I think utilizing those websites is really important to help build consumer confidence in buying that product and preparing it themselves.
Martha, I really appreciate your call. And Marianne, I have seen that website. We'll put that up onto our website, a link to that. And if you have leftover lobster, it's a great place to find something like a recipe for lobster mac and cheese or lobster tacos or something like that, isn't it?
Yes, we've put together a lot of resources for the home cook this year to make sure that people are comfortable cooking and preparing lobster at home. And so it's basically got everything you need. We've seen our usage numbers really skyrocket this summer for those resources.
Well, I'm one of them. I'll go here to a tweet, a Facebook post. What do fishermen have to say about Trump's trade war? Kristen, you're a lobster fisherman.
Well, because I deal with my dealer. I don't deal directly with China. I know last year was, you know, most of the impact. But one thing that people have to realize too is that Canada may be selling a lot of those lobsters to China, but those lobsters that Canada was selling to China, we are not selling in the U.S. So it's still, you know, it's good for the U.S. market. So, you know, I'm not going to get in the middle of trade stuff, but I think, you know, yes, it'd be great if our dealers, you know, could sell more to China, and hopefully that happens in the long run.
I have a tweet here from John. Was just out fishing this last week, and inshore we were getting some dead lobsters coming up in the traps. Ocean temp was 67. After the last 3 weeks of 80-plus weather, the strain on lobsters was huge. And an email here from Carlton. I repeatedly hear that the lobster fishery is highly sustainable. Is it really? The industry takes herring caught by others and feeds it to lobsters until they reach legal size. Now we hear about a bait shortage. It's no different than feeding cattle in a feedlot with corn grown on irrigated land with the aquifer being depleted. Pat?
So, there has been a bait shortage. The Atlantic herring stock certainly is in decline. We've just made very big cuts in order to ensure that stock recovers. There is a recruitment issue there. There could be some link to climate and climate variation with the health of that. So it's hard to say. I don't believe you can just link it to, well, they need all that bait, so the lobster may be sustainable, but now herring is not. Under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, we have to manage all these federal fisheries sustainable. The commission has sustainability standards. So I believe they are sustainable. Do we have hiccups in the management process? Are there mistakes? Is the science off? Sure, those things can all happen. But at the end of the day, I think we've got a lot of variation in bait that we can use. The industry has done a good job bringing other bait sources to the table. Menhaden pogies this year, last year, the year before, have really kind of filled a niche for the bait market. So those are all good things to help ensure that the fishery survives and we continue to manage things at a sustainable level.
I'm glad you mentioned Menhaden and Poggi, and we just have a couple minutes left, Pat, but I wanted to sort of branch out a little bit since we have you here. Tell me about Maine's other fisheries. How are they doing?
The Menhaden fishery in particular is doing very well. We're entering new grounds from a management perspective. We're using ecological reference points where other species are taking into consideration. This is a very, very new approach from a management perspective. We're not just managing that species in a silo and not worrying about the interrelationship to herring or dogfish or striped bass. So those are good things. To remember. I mentioned herring stocks are in decline, but we've made very big adjustments to the herring stock to ensure that we recover that as quickly as we can. There are some bright lights when it comes to groundfish. Gulf of Maine haddock is at a very all-time high. Those markets have been really hit hard, though, by COVID and this pandemic. And loss of those markets is something that they need to get around. The Elver fishery continues to plug along. They were hit by COVID from a price perspective, but considering it's a 10-week fishery and they were still making $500 to $600 a pound, people aren't making a full-time if year-round living. But from a seasonal aspect, those were some really good things. So, and then the aquaculture industry, while not a wild-caught fishery, that industry, is continuing to grow. It is run in a very sustainable way. It takes into consideration all of the impacts, not only to other flora and fauna, but also to issues such as navigation and other uses. So those all have challenges, but they're all moving forward in a way that's very productive. The 75% number that people keep talking about, 75% of Maine's commercial fishing being lobster, is the one thing that keeps me up at night. That if we don't see some growth in some other areas, if we don't find some other benefits, and we see a decline in lobster in the future, be it from a climate perspective or whatever the case may be, what's the backfill there? So those are the things we need to continue to look at as we look at the future of our commercial fisheries and aquaculture in the state of Maine.
All right. And Pat, amazing to hear that Maine's haddock is at an all-time high. All those years of worry about that fishery, that's some great news to end our program on. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here on Maine Calling today. The voice you just heard, Pat Kelleher with Maine's Department of Marine Resources, Mary Ann LaCroix, Executive Director of the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative, and Kristen Porter, Board President of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Stay with us for today's briefing with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. That starts soon on Maine Public Radio, television, on website, and our Facebook page. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. All sorts of resources at mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.